hello and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and Child Protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think. The Thin Blue Mind, with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
So hello and welcome to this episode of The Thin Blue Mind. This week we're going to be talking about that thorny issue of stop and search. I'm well aware that perhaps some people listening to this podcast will perhaps not know the ins and outs of legislation. But basically stop and search, it's what we call a Section 1 PACE search, Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984. And there's also search for drugs, which is under different legislation, but essentially the grounds are the same thing. There are other legislation to cover searches, such as the Terrorism Act and firearms, etc. But today we're just going to be basically dealing with prohibited items and drugs. So what is a prohibited item? Well, it's going to be a weapon, stolen property, anything in connection with going equipped. So that's anything to assist an offender to commit a crime. And there's various guidelines that the police have to follow in order to do those searches. The most important thing, I think, is the reasonable grounds that an officer forms to conduct that search. We're going to be exploring this in this podcast. So what are reasonable grounds? What reasonable grounds aren't is that, you know, we can't obtain grounds by questioning. So we can't stop somebody, speak to them, and then form the opinion that, perhaps they need a search. So I'm going to open it up to Steve and Richard as to what are reasonable grounds.
Well, you start off possibly in a hierarchy of grounds, perhaps. You first, I think, would be intelligence or information. You have intelligence about a particular person or about a particular location or information about that leads you to reasonable grounds to suspect that they either have controlled drug on them or they have stolen, prohibited fireworks, I think is another one. Or articles for burglary, theft or cheat about their person. And if that's good, solid intelligence, good information, that's going to enable you to start having those reasonable grounds to suspect that they have those articles on the person and that you should search for them. They talk about suspicious behaviour as well. People that turn away from you, hide, seem to be trying to discard something. People that are behaving nervously in the presence of police. And that's a more tricky one because I think some people have got a sort of fairly natural nervousness around police. They may just be not have anything on them at all, but that suspicious behaviour can be a grounds for your reasonable suspicion.
And does that come from a Bobby's nous, a Bobby's experience, a Bobby's in a spider sense? And this is where we have the difficulty, and I think this is where the majority of issues come from, because that's a very subjective thing. It varies subjectively from one officer to another, never mind between an officer and a member of the public, and what they seem is reasonable, and whether it's just us finding a way to get somebody stopped.
You talk about bending the rules.
That's the perception. That's what I'm trying to say. I personally, if I wanted to stop and search, because of the form you fill out and the fact that how impactive it is on people, I've never done a stop and search that didn't warrant it or didn't have that reasonable suspicion. But it's my reasonable suspicion.
It's totally subjective, isn't it?
It is. And as you say, you've got some information, there's going to be a spate of burglaries or there's going to be X, Y and Z happening on this little estate or these number of streets. Or it might be that Steve Bradshaw is looking at committing some crime on that area and it comes in through Crime Stoppers. Is that enough? Of course. And it, subjectively, because that's quite an objective test as well, reasonable person would say, well, you need to go down there, officer, and you need to go and deal with that issue. So that's, for me, I think, passes an objective test, passes that, it jumps that void between the public and the police.
It is a very tricky one. My bread and butter on stop search was on proactive teams, where you'd have perhaps a problem with cars being broken into overnight in a particular part of a small market town and just be there at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and somebody's mooching along and looking down people's drives and what have you, they're going to get turned over, for want of the phrase, they're going to get their pockets searched. Yeah. And
And I think that'd be the right thing to do, wouldn't it?
And it would be, because you've got information that there is a crime pattern happening. You've got the time of day, which there's not that many people wandering around looking down people's drives at 3 a.m. So you've got that suspicious behaviour thing going on as well.
And maybe we could break that down, because, and I'll use the example and give it to you both, is that if you have a known burglar in an area of high crime and that's all you had, would you be searching them?
Yes.
No.
Brilliant. Go on.
Well, okay. You say known burglar. Are we saying somebody who we've got information that they are active, because that would give us our further intelligence? Is it somebody who's just got out of prison? Is it somebody who last had a criminal conviction for burglary 5 years ago? Obviously, there's a little bit of knowing your patch, knowing your people, knowing who your targets are. I'm not saying I won't stop and speak to them, because I think good communication skills can reveal sometimes the reasonable
suspicion.
But
remembering that we can't obtain grounds by questioning.
No, of course not, because obviously, but you can speak to somebody. There's nothing wrong with saying to somebody, oh, hello, Dave, because one, I know who you are. What brings you out around here at this time of night? Would my interest be piqued? Yes, it would. Would it immediately give me ground as I pull up? No.
Go on, Richard.
And for me, that known burglar has kind of a meaning for me. For me, known burglar is someone that we know is, or we have information, is currently active in burgling. Condition I've put on it would be perhaps if they're 100 yards away from their home address, perhaps not so concerned unless the information is that they're doing local burglaries around where they live. If they're some distance from where they live and where they frequent, my interest is piqued. And I've got information then, is being somewhere away from where you live and being a known burglar something that I find suspicious? Yes, it is.
I suppose the point I'm making is that it's not just one piece of information, is it? It has to be a collection of, if we use that same scenario, so known burglar, high crime area, but now we're looking at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Even when Richard said it was a distance away from their home address, or they were acting, you know, they just something was a little bit off, that would probably tip me into it as well.
And I suppose it's that thing at the back of your mind, isn't it? Doing the right thing, saying this guy is probably up to no good and I really should be searching him. But perhaps we don't have the grounds to do that. And that can cause a conflict in ourselves, can't it?
It can, but it's correct in my mind, because we are the police, the public are the police and the police are the public, etc., etc. It's a common mantra. I think we're quite unique in that respect in the UK, and we need that rule book to play to.
Personally, I think one of the biggest mistakes the police make is they don't accurately record the grounds for their search. They just put the stock phrase, furtive behaviour, high crime area. What does that mean?
You have to have more than that. As a sergeant, as a response sergeant, part of what we have to do is to review every stop and search done by a member of the team and look at their grounds. In almost all cases, I had, I guess because it's an expectation, well-written and comprehensive grounds where you could stand that up, you could go to an external scrutiny panel and be able to read the grounds and say, that's why the officer searched them, and that was reasonable grounds to suspect in relation to the power that they'd exercised. The College of Policing has got their best use of stop search guidance, which includes, I think, that supervision should be reviewing all the stop searches that are done by those that they supervise. And that's a decent stop check if the supervision is making sure, and if the grounds aren't properly there, to bring the officer in, discuss it with them, either as a, you know, as a learning point of view, that these was the more, there was more, why didn't you write it down? I know it's an extra few lines and stuff, but this is going to go to external scrutiny and it needs to stand up.
Well, I remember the old stop search forms. There was very little space to put your object in. I mean, we're all electronic now, and you can put as much or as little as you want. But it didn't. The old forms weren't an encouragement to be quite detailed about why, because there was very little space to put your reasons why.
Yeah, and you couldn't write on the back because they were carbonated. So you had to give them, the person you were stopping, and it had the grounds on it then. And you were either writing very small or not. But you're right what you say, Richard, about first-line supervision being really robust. That has to be such a basic minimum standard. And other times, if you find, and we've all had them on teams who shall we call them, the thief taker extraordinaire, and people, there's loads of stop checks going in, a lot of arrests going in, you might find that sometimes the grounds are just not there. Part 1 of 1 leadership is to say, you're wrong, and look for ways to develop that. And not just embrace the, I'm not saying all thief takers like that, because some thief takers are absolutely fabulous, but you might get the thief taker who's dancing on the line, and it's supervision's responsibility to just edge him off that line.
I couldn't agree more, Steve. I think that is an important thing. But we're talking about the classic, we're searching you for stolen property, we're searching you for going equipped articles, burglary, theft or cheat. But the elephant in the room is that the vast majority of our searches across the country are not for going equipped articles, fireworks, firearms. For drugs. A lot of what we do is around drugs, and a lot of what we do seems to be around possession of cannabis in particular, and street possession of cannabis, and searches based on sometimes the smell of cannabis on a person. That, I think, is the area of stop search that causes issues when we're using stop search for drugs, and particularly that impacting on black minority ethnic communities, and seem to be, whether it is or not, disproportionate. I think that's where a good chunk of our disparity comes from. It's in how we use that power under the Misuse of Drugs Act.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned about the smell of cannabis, isn't it? Because it wasn't that long ago, I think, that the College of Policing ruled, or a policy, was that just merely the smell of cannabis on its own were not grounds to conduct a drug search.
We had a training in Lancashire for everybody on stop search that included smell of cannabis on its own is not reasonable grounds to suspect that somebody's in possession of cannabis.
Is it advice or is it?
It's advice. It's the College of Police Best Use of Stop Search Guidelines. Some forces have just said, nah, not interested. Some have implemented it, some have part implemented it.
I have a question then for you, Richard. As a uniform sergeant, and I'm one of your PCs, and I put on reason on my grounds for search and my suspicion that there was a strong smell of cannabis coming from this vehicle. I searched 5 people on this vehicle. Something was or wasn't found. It doesn't matter whether something was or wasn't. And that came to you. Looking at the guidance that you've got there from the college, what would you do?
From the guidance from the college and from the training that we've had through the constabulary, which everybody at one point went through, it hasn't been repeated. There's a lot of things. It happens once and then it never happens again. Mm-hmm. My understanding would be that the smell of cannabis alone was not sufficient grounds. Do I agree with it necessarily? No. But...
but again, it comes down to ground. So, all right, let's just say that the smell isn't enough. But a couple of the people, the glassy-eyed, they look under the influence. You know, that's an extra bit of evidence to give you reasonable grounds then, isn't it? That's over and above the smell of cannabis.
There's ripped Rizzler papers. You'd look for other bits and pieces in there. But just the smell on its own, from the training that everybody in the constabulary has been given and the guidance that's come from the College of Policing, it is not enough. Now, it matters not to me whether I think that's right or not.
But isn't it interesting about legislation? Because as an ex-traffic officer, if I stop somebody driving and they smell to cannabis, under the stop search, that isn't enough to search them. But it's certainly enough to give them a drugs test. And there's a disparity there, isn't there, between different legislations. I suspect you've taken drugs, so I'm giving you a drugs test, but I can't search you.
It's a disciplined, uniformed service. You should be acting in accordance with what direction is being set from the chief team. And if what they're saying is a matter of policy for your constabulary, and what they're training is the smell of cannabis alone is not enough to ground your search. And if you've got nothing else but that, then your training and the policy that's being set locally is that that is not enough.
I suspect that policy was brought in for, and I've just come back from London, and the amount of people I walked past and got a really strong smell of cannabis, I suspect maybe that policy was brought in for that reason, where the only thing you have got on the streets is that smell of cannabis coming from a particular person.
Could it be that we're trying to remove some of the subjective decision-making in a way, the easy-to-go-to pieces of decision-making, shall I call it? The old glassy-eyed appeared under the influence, or there was a ripped-up Rizzler paper, like you've both said, which will probably tip you over. Are we asking good people to articulate certain things sometimes when we've got the grounds as it is? I'm not saying people would deliberately lie to embellish the grounds. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is, are we asking for another layer of subjective opinion, even more?
Well, is enough enough, wobbly, I suppose, is what you're saying, isn't it?
I have reasonable suspicion. I have grounds. I think there's cannabis in that car. I'm going to search for it. Who am I explaining myself to? Ultimately, am I explaining myself to a court?
Well, I suppose ultimately you are, because if you do find something and they try to tear apart your reasonable grounds for finding it, bizarrely, absurdly perhaps, that evidence may be inadmissible.
And you'll find that the defence are hitting me over the head with the College of Policing guidelines.
Yes.
Potentially.
Yes.
When really, when it came to it, I'm an honest cop And I smell cannabis. Can it not just be that...
I still think, I don't think we record enough detail.
What we need is a stop and search policy that is fit for purpose across the force, that will service the boroughs of London, Birmingham, Manchester, but also the rural communities of Lancashire and Yorkshire. What consultation do we have? Everyone has an opinion. Everyone's free to articulate that opinion on Twitter, etc. But what is it that the public want us to do?
The very first person you're going to explain yourself to is the person who you're going to put hands in their pockets. So when you're talking to somebody, and I think this probably plays in well to an area where more police are using body-worn video, is that when you're stopping searching someone on the street, the first thing you're telling them is, my grounds for searching you are. That's right. That's the number one thing. You're explaining to them why you're searching them. If that is reasonable grounds to suspect under one of your two powers, it's never not going to be reasonable grounds to suspect, no matter where they're from or who they are.
There's a study by the College of Policing that looked at 10 years of data from 2004 to 2014. And this is what they found, that they found stop and search only had a small effect on levels of drug offences and burglary and none at all on violent crime. Many experts are saying the use of stop and search is not an effective tool in tackling violent crime, as it fails to address the main root of the problem. I was quite surprised to see that they're saying it wasn't effective in tackling violent crime.
I think this is a mixed bag. Some officers will say, no, I'm going to do it. It's the right thing to do. I've got the grounds. I'm going to do it. I can explain myself. And other officers are thinking, you know what? It's just not worth the hassle. Because for many, many myriad of reasons, they don't have supportive leadership. They don't feel supported by a senior management team. They don't feel supported by the government. Why am I putting myself through that when there's just going to be a complaint at the end of it and I'm going to have to be explained? I'm going to have to explain myself, or I'm going to have to be interviewed by a PSD.
I think the figures would say that stop and search has declined since 2018.
Oh, okay.
It's been in decline as use of police tactic. The caveat for that is that about two-thirds of all the stop and search that goes on in the country is in the big forces, the Met, West Midlands, Merseyside, Greater Manchester, mm-hmm. South Yorks, or say West Yorks rather. What happens potentially in Lancashire or Surrey or whatever isn't going to have a big impact on the national figures, because so much of it's happening in the big metropolitan forces. The stats, I think, would say it's been a declining tactic. Part of that maybe that there's fewer of us and we're not actually going out doing the sort of proactive patrol that would lead to stop searches.
I certainly think that's a big part of it, actually, because working night shifts many years ago in uniform, myself and colleagues, you know, quite a few people would be coming in for going equipped and things like that. I can't think when I was on CID of having dealt with somebody that had been arrested overnight for going equipped, because we're not being reactive anymore. We're just, proactive. We're just reacting to the incidents that are coming in on the radio.
When I joined 30 years ago, one of those pieces of law that was passed over to you was, if it's between 3 a.m. and 5 a.m. and it's not a milkman, you ought to be taking a close look at it.
And I'm not criticising officers, because you're flying to a code one, an emergency incident, or you're backing up a colleague. How many times, and it's happened to me, where you're driving and you're going from job to job, but you're driving past somebody and you thought, I wish I wasn't going to that job, because I would have stopped and spoke to that person and see what they're up to.
Absolutely. But the demand and the push of demand is such, from about an hour into the shift at best, and you'll probably notice as it is, you're pretty much all in with your mobile resources on response.
Yeah, the demand coming into control rooms
has horrendous.
Risen exponentially over the last few years.
We're not as proactive as we once were, which kind of brings us to a strange situation, really, because in that the police are under so much criticism now for searching people. And Richard, you mentioned it, particularly black people in the metropolitan area. Certainly, probably London's going to be the biggest area.
Well, racial disparity is definitely an issue that needs addressing and explaining and properly understanding. There's various figures you can find that you are between 4 and 9 times more likely to be stop searched than a member of the sort of majority white population from a black and minority ethnic background, which is odd, because this is persistent. You know, whichever way you dice it, the raw figures, you come up with some form of racial disparity in the searching.
Because that would suggest some sort of prejudice or bias, wouldn't it?
It might do. There's lots of different explanations, and one of the possible is that the police are a racist organisation who are looking for opportunities to search black people.
There's your soundbite.
Yeah, indeed, there is your soundbite, and that's that's one of the things that, that gets said about us. We have the institutionally racist thing, which comes from McPherson and probably sits under quite a lot of this consideration. And certainly it sits underneath the College of Policing best use of stop search, with them looking to promulgate some search guidance that would address this disproportionality. The idea was that we were stop searching black minority ethnic people for drugs. And if we stopped searching people on the smell of cannabis alone, that would do something to address the disproportionality of the search.
Is that a driver for that, do you think, Richard?
I think it's explicitly a driver for it. Mm. It's looking at what we stopped searching for and what were the grounds, and let's take away the weaker of the grounds from police so that there's less stop search. The smell of cannabis on its own is not enough.
So we have a policy designed to re-level the balance in the amount of black people that are stopped. Is that what you're saying?
I think part of what I'm saying is the number of positive results from those stop searches were really low. I think it was 3 or 4% or something like that that resulted in weapon searches. Grounds are about 16%, something like that. But the positive results of stop searching for cannabis were really, really low. Single-digit percentages.
What I have a big issue with, are we openly, or is the college even hinting at the fact that we are removing the cannabis smell grounds because it will drive down the amount of black people that are stopped?
I think that's explicitly part of it. And it's saying beyond that, that perhaps just searching on those grounds alone, smell, if the results are poor, is the impact on that community such that we're doing more harm than good by having 90-odd percent of our stop searches on young black men, mostly, being negative? They've been stopped, they've been detained for a search, they've had somebody's hands in the pockets, they've turned out the pockets, we found nothing. And if that happens to you on multiple times, that's going to have an effect. If you have a community or a group of people where the perception in that community is that police have got their hands in the pockets and most of the time nothing's been found, no arrest has been made, they've just been detained and inconvenienced and then sent on the way. But if it's happening over and over, and it's happening to your friends and it's happening to your brothers or you...
It's important to say as well, you know, we're three white guys chewing the cud around the table. We are not black. We do not have that experience. We can maybe comment on it from an analytical point of view, from a figures point of view, but...
I think the assessment underlying, I'll say again, the College of Policing guideline and National Police Chiefs Council is that there's a possibility, at least, that stop search is doing harm to community relations.
Yeah.
And that having the sort of stop search where you are explaining proper grounds to people, as we're meant to, telling them what power we're using by the book, if you will, might be more fruitful. We could be better at what we do if those searches on the basis of your smell of cannabis are not getting great results for us. They're not resulting in people not carrying cannabis on the street. They're not resulting in a slew of people being locked up for possession of cannabis or giving cannabis warnings or whatever. But they are resulting in police officers being stereotyped as to our attitudes towards black and minority ethnic people, and that we particularly prey on them because they're black and minority ethnic. I think that's wrong. I don't think that's what we do, but that's a perception that's out there.
I will never say, as middle-aged white man, what a community feels. And this is, I'll go back to it again. Go to the public, go to those communities. And from our research and from our stats and from our crime recording and national crime recording statistics, we have these issues in ascending order, A, B, C, D, E. We have this toolbox of options of what we can do. One of them is stop and search. How do you, the people who we police, want us to deal with that? Without it being political, without it being the next thing that somebody can shout about at the dispatch box. It'll take some work to get there, don't get me wrong, but you need every voice across the spectrum, and it needs to be a considered viewpoint from the mass. We are the police and the police are us, so therefore we try and represent the people and we recruit people from all communities into the police. Are we asking them, with the police hat on and the community hat on, what's the solution here? And that's the bridge, and that's the bridge across that void we have at the moment between us and the public.
I have a hunch, and it's no more than a hunch. Figures say that around, again, about not only 2/3 of our stop and search happen in the big urban forces, roughly 2/3 of our stop search is for drugs. This week, we've got the Mayor of London going off to look at a cannabis farm in the States. 2/3 of our search would be, I think, largely around cannabis. That's still the biggest thing that we're looking for, I think, in stop searching people. Is that dial on acceptability of people possessing and using cannabis moving? I think it is. I think if the Mayor of London's going looking at a cannabis farm, making noises about, although he can't do it, about a de facto legalisation of personal possession cannabis, and we've got places all over the world, in the States, that are doing that now. And you ask the people, like Steve's saying, what do you want us to do? I suspect they want us looking for stolen property, knives, going equipped articles, people going around breaking into places or carrying weapons, rather than rooting through somebody's pocket for personal possession cannabis.
The crimes that affect them.
Yes.
The people who burgled their house last week. That's what they want.
Well, clearly it's a complex issue, and we're certainly not going to solve it in the 30 minutes that we've been talking about it. I think it's going to take a level of trust, perhaps isn't quite there yet.
The Thin Blue Mind, with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
Well, this week it's the turn of Richard Horton to end our podcast as he resurrects his Nightjag blogs.
This is Radio Nightjack on the Thin Blue Mind podcast. Welcome to Down the Dip, the first of the Radio Nightjack podcast pieces. Down the Dip is a song that I was fond of in the 80s by Aztec Camera, with part of the chorus being stupidity and suffering are on that ticket too, and I'm going down the dip with you. So I wanted to look back over the 10 or so years since I stopped writing the Nightjack blog, an accursed decade of policing, where we've seen huge cuts to numbers, both of officers and staff, from a government that believed that they had crime beaten, that they could cut police numbers with impunity, that crime would not rise again. Well, we know how accurate that prediction was. They thought that they could cut funding to policing. They thought that they could pay freeze police officers, that they could rejig the pensions so that officers would work longer and pay more for a less good pension. They must have been rubbing their hands together in the Treasury. They must have been rubbing their hands together in the Home Office. Probably were. They sold off many, many police stations. Most of those police stations that are at the heart of communities, the ones in small towns, large towns, those that were scattered throughout the various areas of a city. We've seen a retreat over the last decade into large, out-of-town police stations, centralised custody facilities, all of which, I guess, has turned out cheaper, but it's certainly not better. If you're in a small market town and you've lost your police station, you no longer have a sergeant and a number of police officers that parade on in your town and work in your town and feel an affinity to your town. You have people that are coming from far away that have got perhaps 20 or 30 minutes drive at the end of their shift to get back to the base where they actually operate from in the local big city, or rather in the industrial park on the outskirts of the local big city. It's made policing less local. It's made neighbourhood policing more difficult to do. It's been a bad decision, but it happened. And it'll be very difficult for us to get back to the situation where we have those police stations in the heart of communities, because they're gone. They're wine bars. They're restaurants. They've been developed into flats, but they're gone. And they're not coming back. Throughout this decade, we've had an increasing demand of bureaucracy on policing. We start with the National Crime Recording Standards, David Blunkett's idea that the police somehow weren't giving a fair shake of the stick to all sorts of minorities on recording crime and investigating crime. So he's going to build a system that means that we have to record everything that might possibly be a crime. And we fudged it, and we tried to do what we were doing before, and we got inspected by a Magistrate Inspector Constabulary. And they looked at police services and put these incredibly critical reports in, saying how bad our crime recording was, and that things were dropping through the cracks, and that forces were failing. It was public criticism. It was hurtful criticism. It was probably justified criticism as well, because if the standard's there, we should be using it and we should be observing it. So we've had an industry and IT improvements which have sought to make sure that crimes are properly recorded. Heck, under the College of Police, we've even got to the point where we've decided to record things that aren't crimes as crimes, and that hasn't gone very well when it's challenged at court. I digress. We had IT systems brought in that sought to match and collate all the data that comes into policing to ensure that not a crime was missed, not an opportunity for a crime report was missed. If an incident generated a number of separate crimes, all of them would have to be properly recorded. And those systems that were brought in were sold as being faster and more efficient, and they may be faster and more efficient to audit or to inspect. I suspect that is the case, but they're certainly not faster and more efficient to use than what went before them, for the officers having to input data onto those systems. In my own time, As a supervisor, as a sergeant, I watched officers unavoidably having to come back into the office and spend three or four times as long as they would have previously taken inputting crimes and data at the end of their shift. Time that could have been spent out on the street, but was in fact spent running a computer system that was not really fit for purpose. So the computerisation, the new IT for the police has generally not been at all good, but nobody listens. Everybody says, oh, it's down to the users. The users, they just need to get used to it. Not right. These systems are throwing grief and glue into police processes, and they're not going to get any better until we get some proper systems that are designed with user friendliness rather than inspection friendliness in mind. We look at the College of Policing. We look at what we currently have with graduate entry. It's been something that's been coming for years. I know the dream, it seemed to me, was to have the College of Policing standing over the routes of entry to policing and eventually the routes of continuing in policing. And graduate entry was a system which was brought in, which means that if you want to join the police, you must be a graduate, or you must have done a relevant policing degree, or you must be on the graduate apprenticeship scheme and working towards a degree in your time in policing. It hasn't been implemented well. It was meant to sort of facilitate this idea from the Windsor Report, which I'll go into on another podcast, of the dip-in, dip-out view of police servicing. You could just dip in and dip out, do a short service commission kind of thing, do 5, 6, 7 years in the police, then come out and influence the world for good on behalf of policing. Daft idea. But of course, there's now kickback against this graduate entry from forces. Some forces are negotiating an extension of the old scheme, where you needed a couple of A-levels, I think, and 5 GCSEs to get into policing. There are increasing numbers of reports from officers that are going through the graduate process saying they're not being given time to do their degrees, which they're meant to have in work time, but they're having to do it on their own time. Family and home life is suffering, they're suffering. But even worse, all of them have cottoned on to the fact that what they really want to be is a police officer and not a graduate. And that in terms of entry, nobody cares whether you get a first-class policing degree or you get a third-class policing degree, as long as it's a pass. And you can get through by doing the very bare minimum whilst continuing to enjoy a policing career. Now then, if it's meant to have academic excellence, academic ability, written into the core of policing by making it an academic occupation, and yet you can actually slide your way through it and still come out with an acceptable result, that suggests to me that things aren't quite right with the graduate entry scheme. And the number of forces that are kicking back and saying, actually, we want to carry on with the old one for a while, yeah, the old scheme, that tells its own story as well. So there you go. 10 years of policing reform that, to my mind, hasn't made policing better, hasn't made policing more properly accountable to anything other than stats, hasn't made much of an impact on public confidence in policing, hasn't made any impact on the police ability to investigate and solve crime and to control disorder. This is just a sketch through, and Radio Nightjack will go, I hope, into more detail over the coming months and years as to where those reforms went wrong and, if it happens, any changes that are going to try and make things better, that are going to try and get us away from this cursed decade. Anyway, that's enough for now. That's enough for this little podcast of mine. And this is Radio Nightjack saying thank you and good night wherever you are.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. This podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time and the next podcast, take care.